Okay, Susanna, I think that you are one of the best hosts, probably not just in soccer, but in sports in general. But I'm going to do the opening today, and I would
Okay.
like your feedback after.
Absolutely. Happy to give it. I believe in you.
You're listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental.
TMZ, oh my goodness.
I think he's the philosopher of football.
I'd like to have some more derbies.
Absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory. We're trying to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from a city 3.5 hours northeast of Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, this is Extra Time, driven by Continental. I'm your host today, filling in for David Goss and Andrew Wiebe. I'm Bobby Warshawn. With me, Chicago Fire biggest fan in America, Susanna Collins.
Bobby Warshaw, I just have to say that you absolutely nailed that intro, my friend. And yeah, you know what? So happy to be here. Happy to be your co-pilot today.
Here being the AT&T MLS Studios.
The AT&T MLS Studios. They're ours today, Bobby. We own it.
We do. Man, that was nerve-wracking.
You were great.
Intros are really
Can I just say, like,
scary.
Listen, that was bold. You committed and you went for it, and I really loved it. Like, you really sold it. So I give you like A plus. It was creative. It was fun.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I liked my little tee up. It was fabulous.
All right. Well, let's get straight into it then.
I think we should. Why not?
Let's do the MLS news and notes first.
Okay. Well, okay. We've got some good news for San Jose because they need some good news. Let's be honest. After a little rough decision day presented by AT&T. Okay. So the good news for San Jose looks like Matias Almeida staying put. Bobby, despite some rumors that he was going to maybe head back down south to Liga MX.
Very good news. Extraordinarily good news for San Jose and Major League Soccer.
They can be super, super happy about that. Because, I mean, I know they did not make the playoffs. However, it cannot be understated what he was able to do with that team, especially considering the slow start that they got to. Whatever he was selling, that team bought into it, and they were one of the most fun teams to watch the second half of the season. And it's a darn shame that they kind of ran out of steam at the end. But I think they're going to make the playoffs next year, especially now that he is staying. I love that guy, and I just like watching him.
The early Baron T.
Early Baron T. Yes, I'm going to do it.
Okay,
we're San Jose.
It's on the record.
San Jose in the postseason. Also, Wando could come back next season.
He has an offer. According to Almeida at the press conference, they have made the offer to Wando to return for 2019.
So that's also, listen, San Jose, we're here for you.
Opening the show with the San Jose Earthquakes.
We're here for you guys. We are here for you.
Second piece of news. I'll take this one from you. You don't have to do it.
I just want to put this out there again because I'm still bitter.
This is for you. This Dax McCarty Chicago Fire bobblehead doll.
Not even true a little bit. Not even true a little bit. I have asked, I've requested, I've put it out there on the social media, and ain't nobody from the Chicago Fire biting. I still have not received a bobblehead, so there is some Chicago Fire news, but just out of spite, I'm going to let you take this
one. Okay, I will take it.
Yeah.
The Fire signed Alvaro Madron. And I hope that I got that pronunciation right. We don't have the exact one yet. A center midfielder, center attacking midfielder, came through the Real Madrid youth setup, recently playing for Real Vallecano and Alavaz in La Liga, 21 appearances the last two seasons, reportedly a TAM signing to the Fire, who say they want to accumulate talent to compete with the best in Major League Soccer, Atlanta, Seattle, Portland.
Good for them.
Okay,
good
moving
for,
on.
No, That's no, it is. Need. It is actually very good. This one is big, though. This is actually quite tasty for Chicago.
I would just say I felt that way about other things the Fire did, so I'm a wait and see guy.
Okay.
Right now.
Yeah, but Andres Guardado.
The rumors won't go away.
The rumors will
they
not
seem
go
like
away.
They were going away, and now they're back.
But this would be significant. This would be significant, and it might be enough to get me back on board. I'm just
hashtag
I'm just
get
saying.
Susanna back.
Get Susanna. That should be their biggest offseason move, really, is getting Susanna back.
I feel like it's a good measurement for everything else. If they get Susanna Collins back into the Chicago Fire, they have won. They have done everything else right.
Bobby, it's so simple, you know? Just send me. Jillian Sackovitz had the best idea, though. She was like, Susanna, do you know what they're doing? They're like, they're waiting for their opener at Soldier Field against Atlanta, and it's going to be Susanna Collins bobblehead night.
That's true.
And I was like, that's definitely what they're planning.
Susanna Collins Day, if they're going to do it right.
Right? Like, come on.
All right. Let's go from there into really what everyone wants to talk about right now, and really with the people they want to talk about it with.
Yes.
Okay. Let's do the U.S. Men's National Team news, and we're going to bring into the show right now, Total Soccer Show, Daryl Grove and Taylor Rockwell. What's up, guys?
Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, guys.
Hi, nice to meet you. I'll be digitally and sort of pixely.
I know. Isn't it always kind of weird when you meet people digitally? It's like you're like, nice to meet you. And it's like, are we actually meeting? But we are. It's just a strange environment. But it's lovely to have you guys on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
You guys, let's
we would make it Susanna Collins week.
Yeah, we would.
Ooh, they know how to play the game. They know how this works.
I love it. I love you guys.
All right, guys, let's talk about the U.S. men's national team. Nations League is coming up. Game against Cuba, 7 p.m. at Audi Field in D.C. on FS1, Unimas, and...
Tudiane. I just like saying it.
That's beautiful. Tudiane. So good.
It's very sexy.
And then again, on Tuesday, they play at Canada, at BMO Field in Toronto, at 7:30 on ESPN, Unimas, and...
Tudiane.
You guys, I don't know how you're going to match that.
I know.
It's on ESPN 2.
I'm not even going to try.
ESPN 2, sorry, not ESPN. That'll be in my feedback from Susanna later on my hosting notes.
I am. I'm taking internal notes on Bobby's performance right
so,
now.
So, a point of reference. In Gold Cup, Cuba lost to Mexico 7-0, Canada 7-0, and Martinique 3-0. And that's where I leave it to you, Susanna.
Okay, so you look at those matches, you look at those results, and you say, well, this is clearly a game that the USA should win. They should win this game handedly. So, that being said, what is should their approach be in this match? Are they supposed to use this as like another dress rehearsal, or should they be testing players? Like, how do you guys see their approach in this game, and what needs to happen?
I think you go with a semi-strongest 11, right? So, if for example, if Greg Berhalter feels that Giassi Zardes is his like best striker option because he understands the system more than Josh Sargent. I feel like against Cuba, you give Josh Sargent the start, right? And you see, can he score all 7 goals and match Mexico? And you just give him 90 minutes in you know, proper CONCACAF Nations League action.
Yeah, I disagree slightly in that, like, usually I would say play the strongest 11 we can in the first game and then maybe like a more experimental 11 in the second. This time around, given the numbers that you just threw out there, I would say Cuba is significantly the more inferior opponent. So maybe that's the one where I feel more comfortable with Berhalter experimenting a little bit. But I think it ends the same because I think for Berhalter, starting Sargent is a bit of experimentation. And so that's kind of what I'd like to see is a what I think is a strongest 11, which may be a like experimental 11 for Berhalter.
Daryl, in the history of the U.S. men's national team, where does Josh Sargent finally starting rank in your happiest moments?
Ooh, it'd be up there. It'd be top 20. Yeah. I mean, there's been World Cup matches. This is a CONCACAF Nations League against Cuba.
I'm aware. I'm just saying you put it in the 20. All right.
It's just.
Oh, you're saying he's high.
Yeah, it's pretty high, man.
Well, I've only been here since 2005.
That's fair. Yeah. That's fair.
So you guys
have no 2002 memories. Sorry, Bobby.
So what neither of you said, which I will then also disagree with to go to another slide down the spectrum, Taylor, is neither of you would go at this game 100%. Whether it's slight changes or full changes, what I don't understand about then is at what point do you continue to implement the process, right? If for Greg Berhalter, it's not about trying out players. It's not about figuring out who can hang. Those answers have already been answered, or those questions been answered for the most part, haven't they? So why not go into this gung-ho, much in the same way an MLS team would use a game against a college team or a USL team in preseason and play their first 11 to try and build their principles of play?
So I would argue it's more gung-ho to, for example, not use Michael Bradley or Will Trapp at the six, but to go, all right, this is Jackson Ewell's moment. You know what I mean? I'd say it's more adventurous to give someone like Jackson Ewell the platform and let him go at it. Because if we're honest, there's no risk really that we don't win this game, right? So I think it's worth a little bit of experimentation. Did I just jinx it? I might have just jinxed it, right?
Well, Susanna and I were talking before, and her question was, is there any danger? And it occurred to us the fact that she even asked that question feels like a whole new era. And I think it's a little bit too much of a stretch of a question, but not totally out of bounds to ask.
I just think that when you're looking at teams like, you know, a Mexico team that beat this team 7-0, I mean, they haven't scored against these teams. Like, the fact that I have to sit here and I'm like, oh man, could this be a trap game? Like this should be a game that is a slam dunk. U.S. are going to win. No questions asked. And the fact that there are still just questions lingering, like, I don't know. It doesn't feel good, guys.
A whole new world.
Yeah. That's why I would jump into what Bobby said about like we kind of know who can do what and we don't really need to experiment as much anymore. Like, Bobby, I don't want to misquote you, but I would disagree with that a little bit because I feel like we've seen experimentation in the areas that Berhalter has worked on. Like the midfield has seen a lot of rotation, the defense in terms of who can play on the ball. We've seen a lot of changes. We've seen a lot of Giassi Zardes so far, and it does seem like this is an opportunity to kind of try different approaches when it comes to the attack, because I do think we should expect to have more of the ball, more shooting opportunities. What we do with them is sort of the issue for me, and that's where I would like to see a few names brought in to see how they function in the system and how they kind of improvise in that system.
Right. If not now, then when? If not now, then when?
Oh, wow. You're going to do that?
Oh,
you're going to
wow.
pull that line out?
Well, okay, so who do you want to see?
So I mentioned Sargent. And I mentioned Jackson Yule. I would love at some point to see Brendan Aaronson. Like, maybe it's a stretch to see him start. And I see him as like a Paxton Pomykal call-up for the last games, right? And I think Pomykal got maybe, what, 5 minutes against Uruguay? We've only got 3 subs, not 6, like in friendlies. But I wouldn't be upset if Brendan Aaronson gets the last 30 minutes of this game, maybe.
Mm. And like, mine's not quite as experimental or as exciting, but it's still kind of exciting because what I'd like to see is Christian Pulisic played central, which is not a thing I usually want to see. I tend to be in the camp of Matt Doyle, who wants to see him played wide. I've upset Bobby. That's kind of what I was going for. But in this game, I think, again, because there will be more opportunities to have the ball in the final third to create attacking opportunities, that seems to be what Berhalter wants Christian Pulisic to do for this team. So if ever there were a time for him to do it and look good doing it, it would be now.
I also think, speaking of misquoting, I feel like people are constantly misquoting Berhalter about what he wants Christian Pulisic to be doing. Mm-hmm. So I think he's been very clear several times that Christian Pulisic is sort of left of center number 10, but then he's deliberately switching with that left winger, right? Say it's Paul Arriola, and they'll cross over. Arriola will come inside and Pulisic will go outside. And then when you do the switching, you kind of have the element of surprise as well. So I actually think I like this Christian Pulisic role because it gives him a chance to do a little bit of both. And if Cuba crowd the middle, then he can say, hey, Paul, step into traffic in the middle for me here. I'm going to go out wide where there's a bit of space.
There's so many parts that I disagree with there. I don't even know where to start. Yeah. So let me ask you this.
How does it feel, Bobby? How does it feel to be the host when we just say stuff you don't like?
Bobby's getting twitchy over here.
So when you play against a team that sits deep, and it seems like Cuba will sit deep, right? Then how do you create the chances? Because if you're the 10 in a positional play setup, and your job is to hold those spots on either side of the striker, you know, somewhere 25, 30 yards from goal, those are the spots that are clogged up. So I guess I don't know when in modern soccer an 8-10 gets chances on the ball sitting against a deep block. And I don't know why you would play your best attacker in that spot then.
Would you not think he can do that little switch out wide and find the space?
But why not just start him there? Why not just put his heels on the touchline and give him 10 balls a game, either on the long switch or on some sort of overload, to run in an inferior outside back? Why put him in the packed middle of the field where he has to get the ball on the half turn, which is a weakness in his game, when he's got to play 360, which is a weakness in his game? Why not just go all in on the thing that he is exceptional at?
Well, let's look at it this way. Instead of me and you arguing, Bobby, because I don't want to ruin our friendship,
fight to the death.
Why does Greg Berhalter do that? What do you think he thinks the upside of having Pulisic in the middle of all that traffic will be?
It is what you said. It's the fact that he gets to make decisions and he gets to unbalance them and be unpredictable. And I understand the logic, but think that the logic elsewhere, I guess I just disagree with it. I understand where it's coming from and I'm stating my points as to why I believe the logic is flawed. But so what you said is what Berhalter would say and is a fair statement. I just don't think it's right.
But if you're talking about a bunker defense as well, and then you want Pulisic wide to go at a right back, an inferior right back, to try to beat him on the dribble, you still have numbers behind that player. So even if he beats that fullback, then you're going to pull somebody out. And maybe that creates a little bit of confusion. But I would argue, to Daryl's point, but if Pulisic starting centrally, swapping with another player, swapping back, is going to cause an equal amount of confusion, if not more. And especially if it's indicating that it's been practiced and there are rotaciones to it, then you can sort of start to see the system and what Berhalter wants them to do functioning a little bit more clearly than, I guess, just sort of like, why not just change it up and see what happens?
And to argue against myself, you could argue that the usual reason for playing Pulisic is the 10 is that when we defend, right, we go into that 4-4-2. He becomes one of the front two, right? He doesn't have to do the job at left mid.
Yes.
Against Cuba, he's not going to have to do a lot of defending anyway. So maybe there's an argument he's better wide against Cuba because there's not that much of a left mid defensive job to do.
And that's something we don't talk about enough, is how formations and positions within formations change depending on the phase of the game and the demands of the game. So I am okay with playing Pulisic as a second striker in a counter-attacking mid block. That's for another day. To back up a step, one question I have for you is, what tactical element within the game are you most interested in seeing? And my answer is what we just discussed. How does this team intentionally use possession through the middle and final third to create chances? Because it is not improvisation. It is not through chaos. It is through systematic ideas, which they have been okay at, but not great at. And I'm interested to see how they develop those. That is my answer to this question. How would you guys answer that? The tactical element that you want to see the most?
First off, I wrote down that answer word for word because I was going to steal it from you and say it myself first. But since I can no longer do that, I would just emphasize what you said, because this is a Cuba team that we should expect to get at least a couple goals against. And that's not a thing you could say about a lot of the opponents the United States has played, Gold Cup group stage aside. And so this is the opportunity, I think, against a bunker team to see if the United States does more than sort of play it wide, look for hopeful crosses, look for long balls over the top and kind of counter attacking opportunities. I do want to see, to Bobby's point, how they build up, how they kind of interchange and pass and move and pull Cuba out of position to create space for other attackers to occupy. So how they sort of create those opportunities is something I'm equally excited about. And then a minor thing would be Zach Steffen's distribution is another thing that I'm going to keep maybe my left eye on. The right one will be on attack, the left eye on what Steffen does, just because his distribution has at times looked erratic. But then for Dusseldorf, it's looked fine from what I've seen. It's looked good from what I've seen, and he has looked very good. So how he functions in helping the United States keep and maintain possession from the goalkeeper position is another slight thing I want to keep an eye on.
To build on that, I would say I'm interested to see how far up the field does Zach Steffen play. Like, if we have a load of possession and Cuba is super bunkered, like, he's not going to be in his 6-yard box under pressure like he was against Mexico in the friendly, right? But is he like outside of his box as a third center back almost, you know what I mean? Like, getting involved in the possession. And then the thing I'm really interested in is, what if it kind of goes wrong and we have lots of possession, like from side to side and side to side, and we're not breaking through, and it's after halftime and it's still 0-0. Does Greg Berhalter have a sort of plan B? You know, like we used to bring on Alan Gordon or Connor Casey.
We should still bring on Alan Gordon. If I was coach of this team, I would still have Alan Gordon on the roster.
Yes.
But we used to have that plan B, right? Let's just aim balls at the big guy's head because this isn't working. I don't see Greg Berhalter.
I think that would physically hurt Greg Berhalter.
Yeah, I'm not sure he'd be able to do it. So I want to know what the plan B is if the positional play and possession doesn't work for some reason.
I just want to know, too, like, who's going to put the ball in the back of the net? Like, that's, you have to score goals. And I feel bad saying it, but like, Jazzy just doesn't really strike, you know, that much confidence within me. And a guy like Josh Sargent, who is, you know, not quite proven yet, like, I want to see how he does, but I just, like, who can score? Who can score goals?
So this is an impromptu question.
Yeah.
But if you're Greg Berhalter and you understand the public response, and we actually have Greg Berhalter coming onto the show, we should say that, coming up next, and we're going to ask him this question. How would public opinion and public response impact how you make your decision?
I don't think you can let it. I mean, I think if you're the coach, you have to just be absolutely, you know, ardent in your beliefs and in Greg Berhalter's system that, you know, he is so passionate about. I don't think he can listen to that noise. I'm not saying it probably doesn't affect him, but Greg Berhalter's the type of coach that's going to stick to his system and his beliefs. But I would have to think that it would be kind of hard to drown out that noise that you're hearing, especially when a guy like Jazzy, who Berhalter clearly just loves and has confidence in, he is such a polarizing figure in U.S. soccer right now. And, you know, I feel like fans either like love him or hate him. And so that has to be, I don't think Berhalter would ever make a decision based on outside noise, but I'm sure he hears it. I'm sure he hears it. But at some point, it has to live up. At some point, Jazzy has to be the guy that Berhalter expects him to be. And I don't think he's done that yet.
If I could jump in there, I would totally agree with everything Susanna said. And I would add that, like, I'm sure you all get feedback on the show that you use, and then you get feedback that you're like, no, wrong. And like, and I would imagine that's probably a lot
all
of
all the emails I send. They never.
Yeah. Right. I know. I think Bobby likes more of them, but I, like, for me, I think that's probably what Berhalter's doing, is he has a system, and Giassi Zardes thus far has played the way Berhalter wants him to play. And so when he sees us all get really excited or disappointed, not excited. when he hears Susanna do a half second sigh before saying Giassi Zardes' name, I think he probably knows, yeah, but he's doing what I want. And so I'm okay with it for now. So I think he probably is not as interested in what the media or the fans kind of think about a player who he thinks he knows how to utilize.
The Susanna side.
There's also...
it's good. It's
the
good.
Susanna Giassi side. so he's obviously very familiar with Giassi Zardes, and I'm pretty confident that Zardes is, as Taylor said, like, fulfilling the role that Berhalter, you know, he probably knows a lot of the movements. What is it that maybe Josh Sargent isn't doing or isn't showing or doesn't know that Greg Berhalter... Let's say we go with my theory and he starts against Cuba. What would Berhalter be asking Sargent to prove beyond just scoring? Mm-hmm. Like, is there something you think he's asking of Sargent that maybe he hasn't seen in the past, and that's the reason he didn't make the Gold Cup roster?
Yes, within positional. Well, the Gold Cup roster is a whole other topic with U20 and everything, but within positional play, the way your striker sets up is very important, because the way every single player aligns, if the point of positional play is to preset positions to ensure that everyone has the right amount of spacing, and when they receive it, time and space on the ball in dangerous spots, every spot that the players take up is important. If the striker messes that up, especially if we acknowledge that the two best players on the team are Weston McKennie and Christian Pulisic, the players playing off of the striker, then yes, where that number nine takes up his positioning and his movements are very important. And maybe you say, we will take a less talented player who does things that helps, that brings out more from the two players behind him.
You think maybe Berhalter's thinking that even if Zardes is not impressing in certain ways, that he's facilitating better performances from Pulisic and McKennie?
I wouldn't go that far, because I wouldn't play Zardes. I'm not making a point to play Zardes here, guys. I'm just talking about the number nine position. Can I actually just say, I'm the host, so I'm moving this along. Just, I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing to say.
Great.
I'm a little tired by the Giassi Zardes in terms of content making.
Yeah.
I'm worn out by it. So I'm going to transition us. Is that okay? Are you guys tired too?
I've been on Twitter.
Totally
I've been
fair.
On Twitter. I'm also tired.
I'm just tired of it. So I'm going to throw out this idea, and I like to play a game, stupid or not. Okay. Why is this team not best suited to play a 3-2-2-1 or whatever you want to call it, a 3-4-2-1?
That's not 11 players.
Well, I don't know where to put the outside backs in this. The 3-4-2-1 that Antonio Conte plays, that New York City have played this year, that effectively Atlanta United has played this year, it's taking over world football. I have some friends who say this is the best position, the best formation, regardless of players. Why is that not what's best for this team, given center back is the deepest part of the roster, attacking mid is the weakest part of the roster, and Serginho Dest, you know, what I will say, God willing, and DeAndre Yedlin would be perfect for it.
So, for example, with Christian Pulisic, would he fit in as one of the two behind the striker?
Yes. And then he gets true freedom.
But then who would be, say, the other one? Because right now it's Weston McKennie, right, in the sort of 4-3-3-ish thing. Would it be another winger alongside Pulisic? So would it be sort of
McKennie.
Pulisic behind a striker?
I would argue that that is McKennie's position. That I've watched every game he's played at Schalke for the last year and a half. I guess I've probably missed one or two in there. But he's an attacker. He is not a defensive midfielder. Right. He is not a facilitator. He is someone that wants to get on the ball, run at players, and get in the box. He is, for me, the new Frank Lampard. So this also would suit him well.
And then you'd have two defensive midfielders behind them, or one defensive and one more attacking? I'm interested in sort of how you would set this up, since you've kind of visualized it.
Yeah, I feel like you've boxed yourself into a trap Bradley midfield, so I'm really excited to hear you defend
that. It'd be Tyler Adams and other. I don't know if that's going to be Michael Bradley. I might even play Michael Bradley as the center back, to be honest, where there's not a ton of running. Right. He's a passer. He can play through a press in that position. He could actually step up into midfield like Alex Ring does for NYCFC. So yeah, it'd be Tyler Adams plus one, and we'll see who that plus one is given form in the moment.
And then are you imagining this in a game sort of like the Cuba game, where we expect to have the majority of the ball, or could this also work against, say, Mexico or at a stretch like Italy, like, you know what I mean?
All games.
And fall into a back five, basically.
All games.
Against a good team. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, the defending is another conversation. I probably would not fall into a back five, but we'll do that conversation another day.
Well, actually, that is kind of where I was about to take us. So here we go. Because you said you felt like Dest and Yedlin are like perfect for that kind of wing back role. And I'm not sure I agree, because I feel like that argument, I'm not saying for you, Bobby, but I feel like a lot of times when we hear that, the justification is usually like, well, DeAndre Yedlin's really fast and he can get up and down that wing. And it's like, well, there's more to a wing back than speed. And like, we watched Dest play for Ajax, if it ends up being Dest and choosing the U.S. Like, he's great in attack. His defensive, like, 1v1 especially is pretty suspect, and that requires then the center backs to slide out and cover. And, like, does that still mean Tim Ream? Do we still have that depth if we have to have mobile center backs who can also play the ball? Like, that's where I think that, like, I take your point that it's a very alluring formation because it does seem like it puts a lot of the best people into the best shape, but it requires such a fundamental change in the way Berhalter has managed. And that's what I always kind of go back to is, what is Berhalter most likely to do? Because as much as I wouldn't mind seeing that, I don't think he's going to try to implement that. Because if he did, it requires kind of an overall change to what he has been working on.
All right, guys. Sorry.
Yeah, we talked plenty.
No, I just real quickly before we let you go, what would mark success for the U.S. in this match? Like just a real kind of like blanket statement. What would be... Other than winning.
Now you mentioned the 7-0. I would love to at least match that.
Yeah. So like...
That's my benchmark now.
Okay. Yeah. So just dominating Cuba.
Yeah.
Basically.
Numbers on the board.
Yes.
Numbers on the board. I want them to run out of numbers on the Audi Field scoreboard.
I genuinely like kind of don't care about the scoreline. I know that sounds ludicrous, but like... It's the thing of like, if we win 1-0, then like, oh, it's Cuba. You should have beaten them by more. If you beat them 6-0 and Zardes scores 4, it's like, yeah, but it was Cuba. It doesn't matter. So like, scoreline is exciting. I would like to see goals because that's not a thing we often see. But more, I would rather see like quick passing and interchange and a sign that like this isn't just being used as like we can run these guys into the ground, but more so this is opportunity to play against opposition from our confederation who we should be able to execute our system against.
Good answers.
Great answers.
You guys, thank you so much for coming on. I love talking the game with you. Your show is amazing. Why don't you tell people where they can find your show and your Twitters?
They can find us on the Twitters, at Total Soccer Show, on iTunes, if and when the update finally works and allows podcasts to be downloaded. Get it together, Apple. And then where else, Daryl Grove?
Every podcast app. I have diligently made sure that we are available on every single podcast app in the entire world.
And can we
just search for Total Soccer Show and
Bobby
you'll find
is the captain now. That's what it says.
Co-captain. We made a co-captain.
Co-captain
now.
Co-captain.
And let's be honest, Susanna's rocking the leather jacket, Bobby. I mean, the loose sweater and white t-shirt.
It's finally fall.
Go ahead, Susanna.
It's finally fall here. So I was like, you know, let's step up the style game.
Producer Anders, when people bash the cardigan, they get kicked off extra time. All right? You guys, thank you so much for joining. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys.
See you guys. Thank you.
Man, always so good to talk to the guys at Total Soccer Show. Let's keep the U.S. men's national team conversation going right now for the AT&T Call to the Field with the man himself, the head coach of the U.S. men's national team, Greg Berhalter. Coach, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Bobby. Nice talking to you.
Yeah. All right. I want to start broad with you and just the way you see the game. And there are different playing styles within soccer and within a national team. Uruguay made it to number 5 in the world playing a primarily defensive style. Bielsa with Chelsea, Tata Martino with Mexico. They're all slightly different. You talk a lot about using the ball and dominating possession. Why is that the style of play that speaks to you?
So I guess what I'd say, Bobby, is more specifically, it's using the ball to disorganize the opponent and then to create goal-scoring opportunities. I think that's what we're trying to achieve. So when you talk about Uruguay, it's a very compact defense that wants to win the ball, counterattack, and score through counterattacking, or they want to score on set pieces. Our aim is to give the players an idea of how to create goal scoring opportunities using the ball, and the whole game is to win, and winning is scoring goals, and we want to use the ball to be able to score goals.
But what happened throughout your career, your coaching path, that led you to that? You know, other coaches use second balls, other coaches use transitions. Why is this the path that you've decided to take?
You know, I've spoken about this a lot. You know, being a defender myself, I always I thought it was interesting playing against teams that were difficult to figure out, were difficult to read, and difficult the way they use space, I thought was intriguing. So as I set out on the coaching path, you know, one of the ideas I had was, okay, how do we become that team? How do we become a team that can move the defense around, use the ball to get them out of position, and then exploit space and eventually score goals? So, you know, that's how it came about. And then it was just about, you know, blending styles, blending, you know, ideas from Holland with Germany and you know, some aspects of English soccer as well. But it was really figuring out, you know, how to exploit space, how to create positional advantages on teams, and then how to turn that into goal scoring opportunities.
And why, within the process of developing that style, do you think it's important to go all in on it? And the game against Mexico last month is the example of that.
Yeah. So, you know, Bobby, we're talking about trying to develop a team, right? So you have to take it step by step. So for us in that particular game against Mexico, we knew they'd be high pressing. We knew that'd be a priority of theirs. And for us, it was about how can we learn from a team that's high pressing. And so, you know, if we weren't going to play out of the back, we wouldn't have learned from it. And that was the most important thing. The guys understanding what is pressure. When five guys are pressing us, we can handle that. When eight guys are pressuring us, we can't handle that. And now we need alternatives. Now we need to be diverse in the way we play. And the guys needed to see that. They needed to feel that. Because in the Gold Cup final, they're pressing us with four or five guys, and we're playing the ball long. And we're saying, okay, guys, listen, we don't need to play long here. Trust me, we can attract them. We can bring them more numbers towards us, more numbers. And now we can exploit that space. So that was a great opportunity, Bobby, to see and to feel what it's like, what pressure is really like.
So now with the national team, and you've talked about this a million times, how it's different than a club team. What's the next step? Because to go from passing and building out of the back, you need patterns in terms of maybe you hit the second layer, maybe you go straight behind the center backs. What is the next step in that process with a national team?
No, I think it's about continuing to use the ball to try to disorganize the opponent. So what you're talking about is if we are being pressed, it's that understanding of how can we play into a striker, back to a midfielder, you know, get behind with a winger. How can we play behind the back line? I think it's conditioning the players to understand what the situation is giving them and then taking advantage of that. That's what it is. When I think about the goals we scored, Bobby, you know, we've scored a lot of goals, you know, in this last 10 months, you know, exactly how we've worked it and how we've planned it. And, you know, that's nice to see. That's gratifying to see. When you think about attracting the opponent to one side of the field, switching the field to an overlapping fullback, crossing it in the middle and scoring, you know, these are things that we talk about all the time. When you talk about, you know, wingers running behind the back line, wing progressions, guys getting in the penalty box, you know, that's a good example. When you talk about in Costa Rica in the January camp, we score from playing direct after they're high pressing us and releasing eight guys forward to press. So there's been glimpses of that. And now it's about just continuing to put it together and continue to build on these experiences that we have with each other.
And one of the main topics around your national team right now is the development and progression of young players. I'm curious for you, how do you know when a young player is ready to get called up into the national team?
Yeah. So, you know, that I heard about some type of debate, you know, on stemming from this SiriusXM conversation. Right. And I think here's the way I can clarify that a little bit better. It's very difficult for us to take a player who's not at the level of the full national team and get them to that level on our programming alone. He needs to do it in the club. He needs to play in his club. What we found, and I think it's, you know, it's agreed upon worldwide, is that you need to play in difficult games to stretch your level, right? So a player is at his club level and he needs to continue to play and perform and progress that way. And then as his level rises, then he's ready for the national team. you know, you very rarely see countries like Germany, Holland, England that are calling guys from reserve teams into the full national team. And I understand that our player pool looks a little bit different. But having said that, you know, these players still need to be performing at a high level to get called into the national team. And then once they're in the national team, then there is absolutely small specific development we can do within a player working with his club. And I gave, you know, Weston McKennie as an example, but there's other ones where, you know, we're writing the clubs on areas we think the player can improve. We have specific plans how to improve this player in this detail, this specific area of his game, but he's already a national team level player.
So, okay. So how do you, so when a player, you know, you take Brendan Aaronson, for example, how do you know that Brendan Aaronson is ready before a Miles Robinson just got called in, or Paxton Pomykal, or Cole Bassett, or these other players, or an Alex Mendez? Why Brendan Aaronson, for example?
Well, he's an example of a, so, you know, it's again, the level that you're playing, the difficult games that you're exposed to. So we're looking at Brendan Aaronson, who's played, you know, 27 games this year in Major League Soccer, which is a difficult league to play in. He's performed for a team that's in the playoffs. So his team has done well. And, you know, this is an example of where we have, you know, where we like to trickle in guys like that, guys who are really close to see, okay, where is he really at? You know, let's get him involved in our environment to see where he really is. And you can do that on a small scale. I think it would be negligent to say, we're going to bring eight of these players into this camp. You know, eight guys that are playing reserve team football or really young developing players into this camp. You know, it's, we're looking for guys that, you know, we have a young team to begin with. You know, we have, I think, six or seven players from the U23s in our camp right now. So it's a young team in general. And I think, you know, the young players that we have are guys that are playing at a high level.
Okay. And you talked about young players, and I want to talk about young, maybe veteran players, because you haven't named a full-time captain yet. With this mix of veteran players and a Michael Bradley, or, you know, previously a Josie Altidore, and the six or seven U23 guys, what is the leadership structure like right now?
You know, I think it's great because, you know, it genuinely is a shared leadership concept where, you know, guys are taking on, you know, a number of different guys are taking ownership, which I think is really important. You know, we could be guiding these guys, but for us to be really successful, we need the team to take ownership of it. And they've done a really good job. When you think about, you know, when we have meetings, whether it's video meetings or team building sessions, you know, the guys are truly engaged. The guys are, you know, we're getting feedback from everyone. No one's shy about speaking up. You know, we have, you know, video sessions that can last an hour because the guys are driving the conversation. And this is the type of, you know, environment that we want to create. And we think it's most, you know, can most likely lead to a team that it works well together on the field.
And then coming up, you've got Cuba on Friday night and then Canada on Tuesday night at BMO. How much are you preparing for a specific opponent at this point when you're in this process of building your principles of play, especially someone as dangerous as Canada right now?
You know, I think in every game you prepare for the opponent. In every game, you're focused on the opponent's strengths and the opponent's weaknesses, and then how you can hurt them. You know, no matter who we play, that's the exercise, right? What are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? How can we hurt them? And how can we avoid being hurt by them? So it's no different. You know, it's a process of scouting the opponent, analyzing the opponent, and now making maybe small adjustments for how we think we could be most effective against them. You know, Cuba, we think, is going to be very compact. We're probably going to need to open them up. We're probably going to need to play more balls behind the line, especially early on, to stretch them. But, and then Canada has a very good attacking group, very dynamic attacking players. And, you know, for us, it will be about how do we get them working on both sides of the ball. But, you know, we're excited for both of the games. We think it's a good step for this group to play in a competitive format, to play away games in a competitive format. This is the first time this group will be doing that. And we think it's a great opportunity for us to grow as a team.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, coach, and good luck on Friday against Cuba.
Thanks, Bobby.
All right. Thank you so much to Greg Berhalter. It's always great having him on the show. And from the coach of the national team, now being joined by a legend of the national team.
You know, we throw around the word legend in this industry like fairly regularly, but I feel like Pablo 100% deserves that accolade.
I'm struggling to hold it together now and not fanboy too much.
I know. One of our favorites, Pablo Mastreni. MLS, former MLS player, former MLS coach. I mean, you've done it all. You've won it all. But we're so happy to have you here in the studio. And we haven't seen you in a while. And okay, I'm going to get weird right off the top.
Yes,
okay,
that's the
because,
best,
Suzanne. I know. So you have always been, in my eyes, one of the most stylish guys in soccer. You know, your look evolved. You were not afraid to take risks, which I always just appreciated from an aesthetic standpoint. And I'm looking at you now, and you look
still
you
got
look,
it.
Still
got it.
Got it. But like you're, it's like you've got like kind of like the chill, like super relaxed, like vibe going on. And I just like, what's your look right now? Like, how would you describe your look right now?
Well, I think it's a little bit of an evolved stay-at-home dad.
<It's>,
Does it well, though. I like how you ask the hard-hitting questions.
Listen,
off the top.
Bobby, this is what people want to know, you know? And also, like, do you remember the mustache? That's iconic. Like,
MLS
legend.
Where's the mustache?
Well, it was cool for a little bit, and then my wife and daughter just thought it was too much.
No!
I couldn't kiss her without her going, oh, that's gross. and my daughter just thought I was like a creepy cartoon character.
So they said they put the kibosh on the stash.
Not to mention we weren't getting the results that I thought it would bring. So it was like, you know, we got to do something
okay,
else.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I get it. Results driven. I can't knock it. Okay.
It's that kind of business.
So I said it earlier. I haven't seen you in a while. So can you just tell us what life has been like for the last couple of years? What have you been up to?
Well, it's been the most interesting couple of years of my life, I think. You know, I think growing up, soccer has always been leading the charge, and going from high school to college to pros and then to coaching, there's always been this pretty standard trajectory for my life. And then I think, you know, when you get let go from a position, you have time to reflect, you know, and I think you have two choices. One, you can get back into it without having a lot of thought or reflection. But I took it the other way. I thought it was a great time to kind of connect with my family again. My kids were 8 and 10 at the time, or 10 and 12. And I felt like I haven't really been present as much as I'd like to have been. And so I went all in and you know, started taking the kids to school, picking them up from school, attending all their events, you know, teacher conferences, something that I'd never done before in my life. And it's been really, really gratifying to see how much effort my wife has put in all these years, and so I think for a lot of people, you know, they think, ah, oh, you're a stay-at-home mom, it's an easy job, and it's one of the most difficult yet one of the most gratifying jobs that you can do. So that's kind of what I've been all in, and going on vacations that I've never done. I've been on a cruise. I never thought I'd go on a cruise like
weekends
this.
Off.
Weekend.
It's a thing.
What is that?
It is weird.
Wild,
right?
It is weird. So it's been great to, you know, to reconnect, and now, you know, after a couple of years, you get that urge and that buzz in the blood again, and you want to get back on the sidelines and continue on. But I wouldn't have traded these past 2 years for anything.
Awesome. And we're gonna get more into that on another episode to come out in the off season. With, I guess we should have said this at the top.
Yeah.
I need the feedback early, Susanna.
Sorry.
17
Drop
year,
the ball.
Two-time MLS World, or sorry, two World Cup, two-time World Cup veteran.
Yep.
MLS Cup winner, Pablo Mastreni is with us.
A resume.
Producer Andres, accolades. Maybe move that up in the episode, all right? Help us out there. So I like that tease, because we're going to do a full 30 minutes with you that'll come out in the off season. Check back sometime in November or December for that. For now, we want to focus on current events. We want to talk about the Audi MLS Cup playoffs.
Awesome.
And you won MLS Cup 2010 as a player. I want to know what was special about that team and what are some variables that we might not notice from the outside that matter to winning playoff games.
Well, that team is quite unique. We came in from the seventh position and we were actually a part of the Eastern Conference at that time, and we battled to get in. I think that that group had a great balance of experience and youth. And really, we caught fire at the right time, which is really important in a one-off situation, win or go home. And so I think, you know, for us, it was about, you know, having a goal-scoring tandem in Connor Casey and Omar Cummings, Jeff Lorenowitz and I in the midfield. We had Drew Moore and, you know, an experienced back line. Go ahead.
I was going to say, who was the right back? Koskora?
Oh, yeah. Kosuke.
Kosuke, yeah.
Kimura.
Kosuke, yes. Kimura.
Yes.
Matt
yes.
Pickens at center back, or at goalkeeper. Love this team.
Oh my God, Bobby, you're just like,
well, this
you're
team,
glowing talking about
well, we
this
so often,
team.
We so often think about talent and top-end yeah. talent. You were really the only top-end talent on that team. No disrespect to Omar Cummings or Connor Casey, but you were the main guy on a team that was pretty meritocratic.
Wow.
Meritocratic. We'll check that later. Meritocracy. Which I love come playoff time. I mean, we talk about LAFC and these great dominant teams, but is it actually an advantage to be a little bit simpler, a little bit grittier?
I think we were taken after our coach, Gary Smith, who was a very, you know, pragmatic coach who instilled in us this belief in ourselves and this, you know, be the best team that we could be, not the best group of individuals.
Yeah.
And you know, players ride that. Players ride the coach's mentality and their belief system. And we made it ours and had a great run. And Brian Mullen was on that team too. We got him later in the year. And so we had an experienced team. And you know, in the playoffs, you need an experienced team, a team full of belief, but you also need the breaks. And if you don't get the breaks, no matter, you know, you could play a perfect game, but if that ball hits the crossbar and bounces out versus bouncing in, it's the difference between winning and losing.
Okay, so having said all of that and what it takes to actually win, considering the new playoff format now in MLS, what team do you see as the most capable of going far, of winning it all?
I mean, it'd be easy to say LAFC,
sure.
and New York City. There's a couple dark horses. One, you know, I think I'll start in the West, Salt Lake, dark horse. But when you got Kyle Beckerman manning the midfield and you have experience up and down the spine, you got Raimondo in goal, and then it's filled in with some very good, talented young players. They've been a team that's been steady all year long, you know. They're my dark horse in the West.
Average age of that spine, by the way, of the seven players up the middle, 31 years old. Only two of those seven are under the age of 30.
Wow!
I found that out yesterday. So plenty of experience up the middle on that
team.
Right, and that's in these games where you're going to, you know, you're going to be possibly playing in LA if you get through, and you got to have people that in that moment can really not only manage it, mm-hmm. but really take on some of those younger guys and put them under their wings and kind of guide them in these difficult venues and these difficult games. And in the East, I would say, you know, Toronto is a team that's been in this position in recent history. They've finished the season off pretty well. And, you know, again, you got Michael Bradley. So I'm a sucker for, you know,
yes.
central midfielders that are just, you know, bosses in there that can really manage a game, because when the bullets are flying and you're up 1-0 and there's 10 minutes left in the game, as much as you'd like to impose yourself as a coach, it's really the guys on the field that take over and dictate how that game finishes up. And I think with those two teams, you got guys in the middle of the field that can do that.
Love that. That's the best comment we've ever had.
I know, that's
on Extra Time.
Delicious.
So the problem, one of the youngest person relative on that RSL team is the manager, Freddy Juarez. First time manager. You navigated the playoffs to the Western Conference Final in 2016 with the Rapids. What advice would you give to him as a first-time manager in the playoffs?
That's a great question, Bobby.
Well, you know, from my experience, it was more the same. You know, it wasn't now you get the playoffs and completely behave differently, change your coaching philosophy, try to impose a new tactic that you haven't thrown at all season. I think he's done a really good job since he's taken over. And I would say, believe in yourself even more. Keep doing what you're doing, but do it even better. Because again, the emotions are already going to be heightened going into these into these playoffs. The last thing you want is to get players to overthink or ask themselves what we need to do differently now. It's about being steady, being calm, and as you know, the head coach and manager, they're looking at you to see how you're reacting in these situations. And so keep stoic, keep believing, and keep doing it.
It is so uncomfortable being in that locker room, and the coach is nervous. It's one thing for the players, but when you can feel that coach is nervous, it is such a weird environment in there.
I was just going to ask, so you've been in these high-pressure situations as a player and as a coach. Which one is more difficult?
Without a shadow of a doubt, it's coach.
Really?
Ugh. It's
you didn't hesitate. I was like, nope, coach, done.
Well, because as a player, you control your own destiny in a lot of ways. You're on the field. You can manipulate the game. You can influence the game. As a coach, although at times I was very dramatic on the sidelines, I wanted to be on the field and helping these guys out. But it's really you're left to your previous week of training, how you prepared the guys. And more importantly, did you create an environment for these guys to feel free and be able to express themselves and make it okay to make mistakes, just not mistakes that cost you the game, you know? And so these are the kind of, you got to give and take, and there's a lot of trust as a coach, and you know, but there's very little effect that you have once that whistle blows.
Wow. I love that answer.
I love hearing former players talk about coaching.
Well, I know.
All the crap we all talk about our coaches, and then you have to do it.
And I love that dynamic. I think it's so interesting. What would any guy that played for your team, how do you think they would describe your coaching style?
Oh, man. Well, I just had the opportunity to meet with Sam Cronin when I was in North Carolina last week. And to be fair, we still stay in contact, so I think that's a good thing.
That's a great.
We should note.
Good indication.
You traded in 2017. Or, I don't know if it was you. Somebody within your group traded him.
It was by far, and I tell him every time I talk to him. It was the downfall of my year in 2017. It was the downfall of the team in 2017. Mm-hmm. And again, you learn a lot as a coach. You know, I think if you know anything, you just. You do for the first time, you're not going to be necessarily the best at. And for me, there's a lot of learning there. And allowing that trade to go through in 2017 was and it was always in preparation for the following year, right? And one of the things, you think you'd know this, I've been in the game for a long time, but the moment anyone starts talking about next year, red flag should be going up as far as we're planning for today. We're planning for this weekend.
Yeah.
Because this weekend we can change the course of our season. But again, young coach and in a really highly sensitive time as far as, you know, the direction we want to move in as a team, the club, and all these different things. But again, those are all, you know, learning experiences for me and things that, you know, next opportunity I get, you got to make better decisions and move forward. But anyways, we got sidetracked. Cronin. I still talk to Sam.
Yeah.
And I tell him every time, worst decision I ever made was letting you go. And we have a chuckle about it. But I'd say I'd like to be known as a coach that appreciates the human behind the uniform. Mm. You know, I think, I'm a true believer that if you can reach the person, you can affect the player. And in doing so, I spent a lot of my time and life energy talking to the guys at the back end of the roster, the guys that aren't getting in the limelight or on the field, spending time with them, working with them after training sessions personally to let them know that they serve as a part of this team. And we're gonna need everyone at some point. And very seldomly in my stint as a coach, did we not use the full roster? Mm-hmm. You know, there's injuries, there's international call-ups, and you want to make sure that those guys still believe that they're a part of this when called upon, and more times than not, they go out and do a great job.
Okay, we're suckers for that. Well, we had this conversation about Jesse Marsh, and his sort of coaching mentality, and he adopts a very, very similar style of making sure he has conversations with the guys who aren't necessarily part of that starting 11, telling them you matter, your moment's going to come. We're going to need you at some point, and really just kind of building them up as people. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, I am not a soccer player, but if I was,
you would be a starter anyway.
That is the kind of coach that I would want to play for.
This wouldn't apply to you. You'd be the star. I also, so trivia we'll get to in 5 minutes, the end of the show is, but who did the Rapids get when they traded away Ooh. Sam Cronin? Think about it if you're listening. We'll come back to the answer at the end of the show. Let's transition now to the national team. We've already talked to Total Soccer Show and Greg Berhalter. What are your thoughts on where the U.S. men's national team is at right now?
Yeah, well, I think it's tough because we're trying to – it's – growth is always on a continuum. And what we want, what we do is we analyze where – we try to say that they're right here, but we don't know where that's – going, right? We don't know in what direction that's moving in. I think Greg has done a really good job of saying, hey, listen, I want to come in and I want to play a certain style, right? And I think we just want results right away. We want him to come in, pick his 11, and have him playing right out of the gates the way that he played in Columbus. And all this stuff takes time. And the hardest thing I think for Greg is not having the players in every day. I mean, when you're talking about, his level of tactical understanding and the way he likes to approach the game requires a lot of time, a lot of video, a lot of day-to-day work. He gets the guys for a week, and they're coming in from different places. And so I think his mentality is fantastic. I think the way he wants to play is fantastic, and I think it's just going to take a little bit of time. And I think, you know, where you really start saying, at what point do you kind of sacrifice – the style of play over results. Well, I think that is where the qualifiers come into play.
Yes, another year next August.
I think so. And I think in between now and then, you gotta know what players you can count on in certain situations. And more importantly, the guys that are going to adopt to your style of play and the way he wants to go about doing things. And so I think all this is kind of just a feeling out process with the players. And in the meantime, you know, I understand where the fans are saying we want results now. But Greg's always been a long-term thinker, and he understands that he's got to stay true to what he believes. Because at the end of the day, if he listens to you, me, or anyone else, then you lose Greg Berhalter in the process.
Yeah. So I think one of the main questions about this team right now, and you are maybe the best person in America to answer this question. Well, it feels like this team could have more bite, that it's a little bit easy to play through the middle against them. How would you fix that? What would you tell a player? What adjustment would you make within the team?
Well, I think what you're talking about is a mentality piece. I don't, you know, you either have a bite or you don't. And too often coaches think that we're going to get this guy and we're going to really harden him up and really give him a lot of bite and aggressiveness in the midfield. You go to a playground and you'll see the kid that's aggressive and the kid that's docile, right? You'll see that in a playground. You'll see that in youth sports. Those kids continue to carry that same personality trait into the pros. And so when you look at someone, you say like Diego Chara, that's aggressive, but that's going to be aggressive every game. That's not going to be sometimes here, sometimes not. And so, you know, and I considered myself an aggressive kind of player. And that never changed. Whether or not I was good with the ball is a whole different story, but that was my personality trait. And so when you're talking about the national team, I think it's just about, you know, Greg's style of play doesn't necessarily have that guy. When you looked at his Columbus teams, Will Trapp was that six. He's got some bite, but he's also he's really good with the ball. He's a thinker. He's the glue that makes everything work. And so, at some point, you're going to have to sacrifice some of that if you want somebody that's going to be in there and be a bit of a pit bull. So I think Greg's got a great plan. I think he's, it's going to take some time. And I think when he does that, you know, Greg's got a knack of making things work out.
All right. So we've got, you're going to be joining us for our Club and Country show for our coverage of the USA match against Cuba. So they've got games against Cuba and Canada coming up. What are you going to be watching for?
Well, better performances, more collective performances, and I think he's done a good job of bringing in a group that's familiar with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Good performances followed with a good result would be great.
All right. Awesome.
Love it.
As we said, check back again sometime this winter. We'll have a full episode with Pablo, hearing about his path, what he's been up to, his experiences. For national team stuff, like I said, you just teased it. We'll be back here on Friday, pregame show, 6:30 p.m. Eastern on all MLS channels, postgame show sometime around 9 p.m.
Yes.
When the broadcast goes out.
Yes, yes. Bobby, producer Anders just said we have time for your trivia.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Good call. I almost forgot about that.
Yes.
Josh Gatt is who you guys received for Mark Birch and Sam Cronin. Was there money involved, too? Did you remember? You remembered that, right?
Yes.
Was there money involved? I don't know if you blocked that out. Is that just the type of thing that you totally like? To be honest, August 2017.
Did you say something?
I don't want to talk about
it. We also got Mo Saeed as well.
Mo Saeed.
Yes.
Of course, I played against Mo in Sweden, actually.
No
way. Before he came to MLS.
Really good player.
Yeah.
Really, really good player.
There you go.
Halfway there. I got half of it.
It was good. That was good, Bobby.
This was career development day for me.
Listen, this was a big day for you, and I just want to say, bravo as your colleague and friend. I'm beaming.
This side of the table is scary.
With pride.
Hosting?
I know. Listen, I know. People think it's easy. It's like not as easy as it looks, y'all.
All right. Well, I'm going to close out the show now.
Yeah. Oh.
Okay. Everyone, thank you so much for listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental Tire, coming at you from the AT&T MLS studios. And next week, we will cover the Audi 2019 MLS Cup playoffs. Anything else? Pablo, thanks
Nailed
for joining
it.
Us. Total
Nailed
Soccer
it.
Show. Thank you. Greg Berhalter, thank you. Everyone, we'll see you later.